The following presentation was recorded at the 2012 Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute. More information at thedocforlearning.org.
Thank you. There are some handouts here in front if the ushers want to pass them out for this session here on the step right in front of me. Some of the things that we're most familiar with we really don't understand, never will. One of those things is gravity, that which is keeping you securely attached to your seat right now. We can describe it. It's also that which we understand keeps the moon in its proper place. It does a wonderful thing, but nobody can describe really what gravity is. All we can do is we can talk about it, we can harness it, we can control things we do. Another one of those is light. We don't really know what light is. Is it a particle? Is it a wave? It can travel through a vacuum. If it's a wave, how can it go through a vacuum? And so a light can be used, so we've learned how to use light. A lot of things can be done. So there's the new LEDs, and then there's also the laser, and then there's the diffuse light here. There are many things we can do with light. We work with it. We know how to make light, how to diffuse it, how to shield it. We don't really know what it is. And one third one I'll refer to is the atom. There's speculation. There are things named atoms, supposedly the smallest particles, but then they're made of smaller particles, and you find out where scientists come to the end of it sometimes when you describe in the middle of an atom. There are these things called protons, and these protons all have positive charges. And if you know anything about light charges, you know that they repel one another very much. And so how on earth do all these positive charges packed into the middle of an atom stay together when they're violently trying to get apart? Well, scientists say there must be some force big enough to overcome that force that makes them go apart, and so they call it, ready for a really profound word? They call it the strong force that holds them together. And so what I'm saying is that when it comes to the basic things around us, our bread and butter things, the things we live by, gravity, the forces in our everyday life, these natural things in the world, light, atoms, we don't really, and I don't think we ever really know what it is, and we really don't have to. We can live a wonderful life in this world, living according to the laws of gravity, using light, and so on. And that brings us to our subject here. It was the committee that gave the title here, Snooze, Abuse, Training the Will. And this idea of what is the will, again, I would say this is something that we see the effects of it. We all have one. We're born with one. If children have one, children's wills are often stronger than their parents' wills. The size of the will is not in direct proportion to the size of the person. It's always intriguing to watch people hold a little child and you see a contest of the wills. And it's intriguing how often the small will prevails over the big will. And so we have a will. The will is that faculty that we use to deliberately decide upon a course of action and then choose that course of action. Now, I produced a handout for this just in case you want to take a few notes along the way and stay with me where I'm going here. But our children, all our children are children of the king. And the education of a prince or a princess requires an understanding of who that child is, a child of the king. And it understands your role as this child grows up then to understand that, oh, I am a prince. Now, I'm not suggesting we teach our that, of course, could develop a prideful attitude, but we are a child of God, the one who has created the world. There's this little account written by Richard Halliburton in the 1930s. He flew various places in the world in an airplane, which was quite a feat in those days. And in his travels, he visited Baghdad. And there was a king there. The king of Baghdad had a son called Prince Ghazi. And he took special attention to training this prince because the prince, of course, was to become a king sometime. And how do you have a prince, cultivate a prince to be a king? And so in his case, he sent the prince to the same school that the soldiers went to. He thought the prince ought to endure the rigors of a soldier training in order to prepare him to be a prince. And so he suffered everything the soldiers suffered. But then, occasionally on a holiday, the prince would come home and for a few days. And on those opportunities, the father, I'll read a bit here, only on holy days, when the school closed, was he allowed to leave his military life and return to the royal palace, where, amid the palm groves and rose gardens by the riverbank, he could lay aside his simple uniform and don the purple garments of a prince. On those rare days, the king relaxed from his severe attitude toward his son and stood ready to grant whatever wish the prince of Baghdad cared to make. So he said, "Now, prince, what would you like to have?" And now this is a risk. Whatever you ask, it will be given. On one such day, Ghazi asked for a beautiful Arabian horse he had seen at the race course. And so immediately they bought the horse, brought it home, and of course the sun got on him with shining eyes and rode away, and the king watched with admiration because this is, after all, this was the life of an Arabian. And so the son had chosen to get a horse, and it was in his heart, "I want a horse," and see, he rode the horse. Well, time went on. Came time for another holiday, and the son came home. Same request. "What would you like this time?" This time, the son had heard of these new machines called phonographs that reproduced music. He said, "I'd like to have one of these phonographs that reproduces the music because that's indistinguishable from the original." So immediately it was bought, and he listened to the phonograph. Next time he came home, he was about 16 years old. "What would you like this time?" Son said, "I would like to be king for a while." And the father said, "All right, in a few days I'm going away on a trip, and you will be king for 24 hours. The advisors weren't too sure about this. The king said, "Yes, it's time for him to have some experience. He's 16 now, so he went away, and the son is king." Well, of course, he didn't quite know what to do with being king. So he immediately, one of the things he said, he commanded 5 cartloads of fresh cut clover to be purchased and fed to his beautiful Arabian horse. So the order was immediately executed, the clover was brought, and the horse was fed. Well, it didn't take too long for that to happen, so he thought a little more. And he said, "Go into the bazaars in town and bring me all of the phonograph records in Baghdad." So they were immediately brought, and he spent the rest of the 24 hours listening to phonograph records. And his father came home, and, well, he was pleased that there was no invasions, the kingdom was still intact. His son had not done anything too profitable, but he had him. There were some times here that this son was given the opportunity to say, "What will you?" And when you ask a person, "What will you?" you do not know what that person is going to say, what that person is going to do. The education of a prince, and that really is what we're all doing, we are educating princes and princesses for the Lord, sons of God, daughters of God, requires critical attention to the development of the will. And there is no formula for this. Consider the prodigal son. He had a brother. I assume they were brought up with similar nurture in the same household, same father, probably hearing the same stories, and you know the results. And why one son goes on a fling, wastes all, and then comes back home, and why the other, staying home all the time, ends up with an offended heart, I can't explain that. But there is a will involved here. In Psalm 40, verse 8, we read the prophetic words, I delight to do thy will, O my God. Yea, thy law is within my heart. Our goal, our ultimate goal, is to imitate Christ in not doing our own will, but to use our will to adopt God's will. There's a world of difference between saying, well, have it your way then. If it's going to be your way, have it your way. Or whether you delight to do his will. It's mysterious. We read in Hebrews, we read that though he were a son, yet learned he. Though he were a son, yet learned he. Now, if those words mean what they say, it means that Jesus learned something. Experientially, he learned something. He came as a man, as a young man. Now, he didn't have the sin nature to deal with that we do, which complicates the matter for us. But there was something for him to learn, if those words mean what they say, and that's what they say. Yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. That is, the things that he experienced. And the Amplified says, although he was a son, he learned active special obedience through what he suffered. In his completed experience, making him perfectly equipped, he became the author and source of eternal salvation. And so Jesus had a reason to learn, to become fully man. He was born as a child, not a man. And he was born as a child, and he grew up. And he learned by experience in growing up what it is to be a child, a young man, and then a man. Now, we also need to learn the same thing. We have the second major element, which is this willfulness. Not only are we born with a will, we're also born being willful. And there's a difference between having a will that we exercise and being willful, where when I want to have something done, it's really kind of immaterial what the thing is, so long as it's my way. And there are people who sometimes would kind of like to actually do something the way it's been suggested to do, but because it's been suggested, I don't want to do it because it's not my way. Now, are you human enough to remember the time when you felt like that? That since it's not my way, why, I'm not really interested in it. And so the end of education, the ends, and what ends are we working towards, obviously, is to become, is to be manhood or womanhood, whatever that includes. And along the way, we do need to, in fact, these things will develop whether we want them to or not, whether we are aware of it or not. They will develop feelings. And our focus here is on the will, but it's a whole separate topic on the cultivation and development of the affections and the feelings. And these are very important to the child. How you feel about being called in here and sitting down when you could be standing out there talking does enter into how you what you get out of this whole meeting. And also we need to work with developing motives and the thoughts, which is another subject, controlling, developing, cultivating the thought life, not only the contents of the thinking, but the way of thinking. There is a way that seems right. And then there's working with the developing the conduct, the behavior, and the character. And all these things are developed in relation to the natural world around us, to our fellow man, to ourselves, and also to God. And so as we work with children, we want to prepare them in whatever way we can to be a member of the body of Christ. Only Christ can do that work, but there is something for us to do in preparation. Now, it's relatively easy to give someone the skills to be an artisan, where you know how to do something. You can produce a good, turn out the product. And that has value, that's important. But that's not enough. It's also relatively easy to train somebody to be a role player, to play a role. This is how you do it. This is how we do things. And you do things this way. And this is how you should be thinking. This is how you should act and react. This is how you shouldn't act and react. These are the skills you need. Once you have them, you can fill the role. And sometimes it's very difficult to tell who is playing the role and who is being real. And you ask, are you for real? Is your heart really in this? Is the inner motives of your heart really behind this, or are we just playing a role? And some people find out when they get in their youth or a bit older that really they have been role playing very well, very well. But really, the heart isn't really in it. And so while it is appropriate to do these things, and we do, in fact, have a role to fill, there's something deeper that we do need to give attention to. The ends of being fully mature, where we submit the will, do drive the means, do affect the means that we take to get there. And so things like focused activity, giving attention and interest, are conditions to learning. And they do have a training effect. They aren't really in themselves the end. To love God with all the heart, the soul, the mind, and the strength does require attention in our educational efforts. We do need to think about all four of these. If we're directed to do it, we better take them all four seriously. If we focus on one, we're going to develop warped personalities. Or at least because the other ones are going to develop or atrophy along the way, and a person who has a exceedingly developed mind and a poorly developed will or heart, or one that hasn't been trained properly, it's a sad situation. And it really is impossible to do one of these in isolation. The other ones are going to happen because all school activities do touch the whole child. And so while we might only be thinking about the mind, the fact is something is happening in the heart, something is happening in the affections, something is happening in the will and the morality, whether we're aware of it or not, and we are doing something to contribute to that for better or for worse by the way we do things. And so the neglect of how the will, which is our focus here, is being trained, can leave the child untrained. And so what I'd like to think about here for a few moments is I'm not talking to you as teachers, but as people who have a responsibility as board members, parents, ministers, and administrators who are to be concerned with what we would call school spirit, the attitudes, the feel. When you walk into a classroom, there is a feel in the air. As children go about their play on the playground, there is a spirit about this. There's a spirit of play. There's an attitude that, and we need to be aware of this. And what I want us to think about is, as you visit school, as you talk with the school children, as you observe, what are some of these things that we look for? What are some of the symptoms? What are some of the activities? What are some of the approaches? What are some of the things that we can look for as we observe that would enhance training the will? And what are some things that would work against that? And so there is that faculty. Our children all have that faculty in them that they use to decide, and then once a decision is made, to actually choose. Now, those are closely related, but there's a slight difference between deciding and then choosing and actually making a decision between this and that, and choosing a course of action. Now, if we simply subordinate the will, if a person simply brings himself under, let me rephrase that. The act of bringing the will into subjection, of subordinating the will, does in fact give the child the experience of having his or her will under control. And we all need to have the experience of having our wills under control, not just free to be willful and do whatever we feel like whenever we feel like it. And with a young child, they need external control so that they are not free to be willful whenever they feel like it. And that does actually give the child the experience of having what he would experience if he exercised self-control. But children do need help to subject themselves so that later on they can exercise self-control and self-direction. It does help prepare us, the child, to be in a sense self-governing in the sense that he submits his will to God. Submission includes active obedience in response to the authorities around us, in response to the circumstances in which we find ourselves, so that we don't fret about being how tall we are, or whether it's sunny outside today, or whether the alarm clock goes. And so there's just a word about the snooze abuse. I think the committee, when we discussed this, we thought of how, when that alarm goes, it tells you nobody can stop the rotation of the earth. What that alarm is telling you is that the earth has rotated a certain amount of time, and it is now this time of the day, and you're not going to change that. It is now time to get up. But, some people, if I could just, I guess I can't change the rotation of the earth, but if I can change my response to the unchangeables, all right, so it's whatever time, 7:30 is the time to get up. But I feel a little better if when that time is announced, if I retain a bit of decision-making here, if I can't slow down the earth, at least I can say, in my own time. Now, so I'll wait 10 seconds or 20 or a minute or whatever it is. And that way I can retain a little bit of control over this. And I feel a little better if, even though the givens are given, I don't have to go with the givens. And so it gives me a little better feeling to push that snooze button and then decide, the earth is turned, but I'll get up on my time. Now, I'm not going to tell you whether you should use the snooze button or not, but there is a critical factor here. There is a training effect. When it's time, there are some things. When it's time. And that's one of the things we lose by not using public transportation more. When the bus comes, it comes. When the train goes, it goes. And it would be nice if some more people would miss the bus sometimes or miss the train rather than just getting in the car and trying to make up for a lost time in the car. There is a training effect on saying, the door will be shut if you do not walk through it. And the will must be trained. There is a training and there is a teaching. When you train, think of the model of a coach working with a person who wants to develop a skill, whether it's to build up your strength for running. Coaches can be ruthless, I understand. I've never worked with a coach, but this person, there is a training that affects more than just the muscles. A coach has to work with this person with the will, the mind, and the skills and so forth. And it must be trained, the will must be trained to act habitually from right motives and worthy motives. Willfulness must be trained out of us. Willfulness is simply the bent that I will have my own way. And there's a big difference between exercising your will, which involves thinking about something and choosing something on whatever basis you choose it, or simply being willful. Well, you really don't think about it. You simply don't want to respond to the givens in the way you have to. You want it to be your way. Habits are formed by repetition, and repeated and continued activity. And so there is a value in this these repetitive things. So this training behavior does have an effect on the will. It's not the only element by far, but it does have an effect. No gifted aptitude is enough without necessary training. And so it doesn't matter how good the runner is, it doesn't matter how skilled the person is. If you're going to really become skillful, you do need a coach, and this does need training. I often am reminded of the story of Fanny Crosby, who, of course, people were kind of pitied the blind little girl, who when people have some kind of a disability like that, people tend to go soft on them, and so people, their heart went out to Fanny. And Fanny had an unusual ability. Fanny could create rhymes very easily. She wrote poems, she wrote songs, and everybody blessed Fanny. This is wonderful. Your poems are wonderful. Your songs are wonderful. And finally she got to a school somewhere, and a teacher, in essence now, I don't know what word she used, but told Fanny, "Do you know what? This is what you're writing can be improved. We need some work here." And Fanny was offended. Everybody had been telling her that this is wonderful. And actually, they were not analyzing Fanny's poetry. They were wanting to make her feel good, and they were using that as a vehicle to affirm her. But when someone sat down and told this blind girl that your poetry needs some work, and worked with it, she had quite the experience to overcome until she could accept this. And we can bless the teacher who faced Fanny with that question. We're still singing her hymns today. I don't know if any of them would be around or not if somebody hadn't said, here is an aptitude that God gave you, but it's going to have some training. Now, all of us have the aptitude of a will, and all those wills need training, and we need people who can say, all children need somebody who can say to them, this needs some training. And so our goal is to have this sense of an inner obligation, what you might call the moral conscience, and then, you know, that we really ought to do. That's an interesting word, that word ought. What ought I to do? And then we do want children to exercise. We don't want them to leave their minds outside the school. We want them to bring their minds along to school and use them. We also want them to bring their wills along to school and use them. It's one of these moments years ago, I'll never forget the place I was sitting in the Farmersville Mennonite School, and it was Eddie Martin standing up there, and it was one of those little moments that's a defining thing you hear in your life. And he was talking about the heart strings. And he said somehow the teacher has to be able to reach inside the heart and have the child do the work he does by out of his own heart. Now that's a $1,000 question, how you have the child put his heart into his work. And so the exercise of to have the training effect that we want on the child, the exercise of the will must be free. We must reach the point somehow. There is always a constraining to some extent with children who tend to be willful. But for the exercise of the will to have a proper training effect, the child must actually have opportunity for it. That is, it must be free to have the training effect. Now, constrained obedience is better than disobedience. Don't get me wrong. We need to constrain children. They may not do things they may not do. But motives impel the child. If the child wants to do something, that impels him, but it doesn't necessarily compel him to do what he wants to do. Explanation, teaching a child, will never be sufficient, and neither will force. That is, we can't regiment children, we can't train the will solely by regimentation, neither can we simply teach them. Training the will requires much prayer. The child keeps his own heart, he has a heart set, And training the will requires wisdom from God, and He will give us wisdom if we ask. We need to be faithful. We need to be sure as we work with children that our own will is submitted, and we can't really submit the child's will for them. So we need to call our pupils to the right, not to us as a person, but to the right, to the Lord, to standards. And in order, when a child then does want to do right, does want to exercise his will properly, there is a feeling aspect. You know, why should I do this? Why should I care? There is a purpose aspect. I'd like to do something. But there's also a practical vision needed. And sometimes children need some help. And this is where it takes much discernment, and teachers and parents, sometime or other, has to have the wisdom to know when the teachable moment is there. There's this delightful story from Farmer Boy, where one summer they were at the fair, and all the boys were buying lemonade, but Almanzo had no money, so he went and asked his father for money to buy lemonade. Does anybody remember that account? All right, so his father looks at him for a long time. And here's his Prince Gazi moment. His father looks at him for a long time. He takes a 50-cent piece out of a silver half dollar out of his wallet, and he shows it to Almanzo. Do you know what this is? He said half a dollar. But what is a half dollar? It's work, son, father said. That's what it is. It's all hard work. I won't take time to read it, but he went over the story of what it takes to raise enough potatoes to get a half dollar. He had the boy recount it all, weeding the ground, preparing the ground, pulling the weeds, picking the bugs, picking, sorting them, harvesting them, and then you dig and so forth. Finally, he said, half a dollar. That's what I'm handing you. Here, it's yours. He said, now, you can have it. It's yours. You could buy a... Now, here's where Almanzo needed a vision. He said, you could buy a sucking pig with it if you wanted to, and raise it, and it would raise a litter of pigs worth $4 or $5 a piece. Or you could trade that for lemonade and drink it up. You do as you want. It's your money. And here was an exercise, opportunity to exercise his will. Almanzo was so excited he forgot to say thank you. He went back to the boys, and the lemonade man said, step this way, ice cold lemonade. And Frank, the other boy, said, where's the nickel? He didn't give me a nickel. He gave me 50 cents. Oh, he didn't. And he showed them the 50 cents. They wouldn't believe it. And they asked him, what are you going to do with it? And here's his will. He decided. And he made a free decision. I'm going to look around, he said, and buy me a good little sucking pig. That was a defining moment. And our children need those moments at some time. We don't know when they're going to come. But as teachers and parents, we need the Lord's wisdom to know when that moment is here. And you step back, and you know the child's heart and the situation, and say, what are you going to do? It's your decision. And, you know, but he needed some instruction. He needed an idea. And Dad gave him the idea, but he didn't say you had to do it. And you feel a little bit, you can just imagine a little bit how God must feel when he says, you could do this. What are you going to do? And he steps back and watches us. And it has a training effect, what we do. And the same thing is happening in our schools. Now, this is, in fact, happening in our schools, whether we know it or not. There are opportunities for the will to develop, and so it behooves us to consider. Now, on your handout, this list I have here, I owe a thank you to Emerson White. He wrote a book called School Management and Practical School Management in 1885, I think he wrote the book. And he has a list here he called the Mechanical School Virtues. These are mechanical in the sense that these are virtues that the child should develop, And they support what are called industrial pursuits. In other words, if the child is industrious and works and accomplishes things in life, these are some things, these are some virtues that he needs. Now, I'll just quickly go down this list. And so now we get to the question, well, okay, let's be practical here. What are some things that ought to be part of the school program that actually have this training effect on the will that we've been talking about? Well, the first one is simply routine. Regardless of how the school is structured, there are routines, by the way. All you need to do is visit a school bed and you will see routines. Some will please you and some might not. But there are routines. But this regularity and punctuality requires a control of your wishes. The child can't just do whatever he wants to whenever he wants to. It does require you to bring into captivity not only your daydreaming thoughts, but also some of your feelings and some of your druthers and in order to stay on schedule. And it does have a training effect on the child to fit into the rhythms of life. Life is going to be very routine, and you better learn it sooner or later. Another one is order, and that is simply following proper procedures. It doesn't matter as much what they are, whether you stand to speak, whether you raise your hand to speak, whether you wait till you're called upon, whether you file in, whatever. But there ought to be procedures, and the practice of following proper procedures, cleanliness of person and tidiness of desk, neatness of surroundings, care of school property. This has a training effect that can go with the child for life. This keeping my property, my person, and my actions in order. It controls that tendency we have to be careless with both the things we do and with the things we have, the school books and so forth. These are virtues to attain, and all of these have a training effect on the will. The will is something that's inner, that's deep. And in fact, we wouldn't want to try to reach inside there and turn it. God doesn't do that with us himself. And he hasn't made us puppets, and our children are not puppets. But there are a variety of things, a sense in which we stand beside the child. Sometimes we put arms around, sometimes we suggest, sometimes we teach, sometimes we are very firm. But in all cases, our hands are not inside that heart. But there is a training effect on the heart. Another one, accuracy. There is a similarity between accuracy and truthfulness. That is, if you're accurate, you don't want to be carried away with exaggerating, or with just guessing, or doing things for show. There's a certain sense of matching your understanding and your expressions with what really is. And so accuracy trains us to pay attention to detail. And that takes some discipline to pay attention to detail and to be precise, whether it's in checking your work, in doing your work, double checking, so on. Attention, focusing on the duty at hand. It's interesting how we use a commercial term here, paying. It costs something. Pay attention. We all have something to pay out here. We can give attention. And it does train the child to keep his mind from just wandering wherever. It does cost something to pay this attention. This has a training effect. Silence, that being still, that inner stillness and quietness, which then gives us the freedom to focus on the tasks that need to be done. Silence restrains the impulse to just say or do whatever comes to your mind. And also to be influenced, the impulse to be influenced by other people's presence. When other people are present, there's a synergistic effect that prompts you to want to whisper and do things with others. And so silence prompts us to discipline ourselves, and it also helps us to overcome temptations and allows the child then to be quiet and to hear, because it's really in the inner heart that we hear and that we perceive. It may come through the ear gate and the eye gate, but if we're not silent inside, it doesn't really get to where it needs to be. So silence has its place. And there can be a rather high decibel silence. Silence doesn't necessarily mean that you can hear a pin drop. I think you know what I mean. There's a quietness we can have while we're busy, and there's also a quietness we can have that is very uncomfortable and unproductive. So I'm not talking about a rigid, fearful type of silence. And then industry, simply work. Steady application to what is at hand. When you're working, there is a constant denial of diversion. I will not give attention to these diversions over here. I will keep focused on what is to be done, whether that's work or whether that's continuing to play the game that maybe I would rather not play that somebody else chose. And so industry, it has a training effect, and this the will's involved to continue what needs to be done until it's finished or until it's break time. Obedience. There are thou shalt, there are thou shalt not. Obedience, to really be obedience, must be prompt. When a child is asked to do something, there is not the snooze button associated with that. I'll do it in my own time. There's a prompt obedience needed. There's also an implicit obedience. That is really obeying from the heart, not still standing up inside. And also cheerful. Children can obey cheerfully. And obedience is not obedience if it's not done because it was commanded. That is, if we only do it because we understand, that's really agreeing. That's not really obedience, although it's fine to understand. And so in school, we can't give time for the feeling of resistance to what needs to be done to come around and play itself out until I'm ready to obey. Now, when you're holding one child and you're only working with one child, sometimes you give them some time. You tell them it's time now to do this, and so they drag their feet and so forth. So this might go on a minute or two. When you're working with a group in school, when it's time to do it, we've got to do it now and do it cheerfully. And it does help to have them understand that all authorities are actually under authority. And we teachers, all of us as adults, our children need to know that we're a bit like the centurion. We understand this authority thing. We are also under authority. And we are under the authority as teachers of the institution and the church and the Lord. And so obedience trains a child to respond to outside direction. And again, this is not original with me. This statement that the moral value of will training depends on the motives that call forth the action. And so we can't depend on things like rewards or regimentation, although they have their place at times to really train the will. There's something has to happen inside. Now, the other list, the means on the back of the paper, this list, you could call it motivations. What are the things that help the child to actually develop these virtues I've been talking about? What can be happening in the school? If you observe the school, what can be happening in the classroom to motivate the children to develop these skills, these virtues? One of them is simply success. When a child is able to master something, that is a strong motivation. He feels good. He actually is able to be successful. Another one is approbation. There's a difference between approval. Approval can come from anyone. It can come from your peers. It can come from disrespectful people. But approbation comes from a person who is in a position to make a judgment and say that is good. It's important that a child gets approbation from his or her authorities. And as board members, if you visit a school, you cannot imagine the impact that your word, a blessing, and approbation can have on the class or on the students. If you just a few words before you leave them a visit, blessing them for their silence or their order can go a long ways towards touching their wills and their hearts. And then knowledge and understanding, simply having the experience of having curiosity satisfied. There is a pleasure in knowledge in a way. There's a pleasure in understanding some of the physical properties and things about gravity and so on. That is a motivation. Activity is another one. The ability to juggle, to jump, to do a somersault. to do other things. Activity that is when it produces the efficient results, when the activity that we do brings the results we want, that is motivating. When the activity we do frustrates us, that's not motivating. A certain amount of choice in decisions is very powerful. Back to Almanzo, the fact that he made that choice. If Dad would have said, now you may use 45 cents to drink, but use the other 45 cents for a pig, he would have had the experience of raising a pig, but it wouldn't have been by his will. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't tell someone what to do with their savings, but I'm simply saying that there is a time that this making a choice and decision on your own has a tremendous motivating effect. Preparation. When the things that you learn and master, when you can see how they will help to prepare you for life down the road, that has a motivating effect on you when you learn useful skills. Honor and respect has a tremendously motivating effect on students, honoring them for who they are, believing in them, giving them opportunity to prove themselves, and giving them a sense of self-worth as God's children. And also a sense of right. If children really have a sense in their heart of what is the right thing to do, that is a motivation. Duty, that's an interesting subject. That's kind of an antique word, but it's still in the dictionary, and it's still as valid today as ever was. And the sense of duty, what I ought to do, that is a motivation. And love for the pupil and calling him to the right, calling him to a standard, and teachers have to do that. One writer said teachers need a generous love that's for everybody, and they need to avoid the kind of complications of getting personal with students, like the teacher pet kind of thing. And last but not least is a healthy fear, that a fear of wrongdoing, and not so much the fearfulness that you're afraid, but the fear that you would dishonor the Lord and others about you. And so you, in fact, are affecting the wills of your students. The wills are being trained. And let us ask the Lord to give us wisdom to know how to be responsible in training these princes and princesses for the Lord.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.